So my question for both of you, do you ever, like, are you ever overwhelmed in the part that the two of you are playing in what's happening here in the Land of Israel?
We are overwhelmed and amazed and humbled all at the same time. And the fact is that it almost didn't happen. Because when we got that phone call, it was a Friday morning. Baruch got a phone call from a friend of his. Hey, you want to go scuba diving to find a snail that makes a dye that was valuable thousands of years ago? Our first reaction was, it's Friday, it's Erev Shabbat, I have cooking, I have cleaning, right. I have shopping, I have who knows what. Why would you want to do that? Just don't bother. And that was our first reaction. And then suddenly we said to ourselves, well, what kind of people are we? Are we the kind of people that are just going to let opportunities pass us by? Or are we going to go for some unusual option, see where it takes us?
Right.
And who had any idea that it would take us to such an amazing place to revive a commandment that had been lost for so many years? I think anyone that made Aliyah understands that also. Anyone that left America and came to Israel cast their lot with a fate that they didn't know they were getting into, didn't know which path it would lead them down. And I think everyone agrees that we're so much richer, our lives are so much richer because of it. And that was something that Tehillat really taught us also.
You know,
to go for it, to take the opportunity, to take the chance.
Well, to be a part of it.
Right. Jump
in. Just sitting here going along for the ride. You guys are making the ride.
You know, but also in hindsight, if you think about it, it's not surprising that Tehillat happened in this way, or that the rediscovery of this mitzvah, of this commandment, happened in this way. It was in the rest of the world in ancient times, it was only the emperor, only the greatest of generals were the people who could wear these type of things. And the Bible comes along and it makes this unbelievable shift in terms of its priorities and says it's exactly not the elite that has to wear this, but every single person has to wear a little strand of blue on their clothes. In essence, saying that a relationship with God or the ability, the potential to do great and wonderful things is not just the lot of some elite few. Anybody can do things that are amazing and wonderful, and anybody can have a close relationship with God, and everybody is filled with potential. And so if this is the way that it's, you know, that the commandment started in such a democratic way, mm-hmm. then the way that it should be rediscovered is also by regular people
by
and
little guys.
yes, us, the little people.
Although it's interesting what you say, because in the ancient world, those emperors and those pharaohs or whatever were also deified.
Right.
So what Tehillat does for the Jewish people is, I mean, what are we? We bring Kiddushah into the world.
Right.
We don't deify anybody.
Mamlechet Kohanim v'goy kadosh.
So by wearing the Tehillat, it's, you know, we're putting Hashem into every day.
Right.
Yes.
And who we are, which is exactly what Judaism is supposed to be doing.
Exactly.
Amazing.
Yep.
So this was a joint effort between the two of you to produce this book. And if I understand correctly, your father also was involved.
That's
in
right.
So talk a little bit about working together as a married couple, because for some people that could be the kiss of death.
Well,
for others, it seems to work. So
you want to talk about that, David?
I really, if you have the time.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Dave and I are both married to doctors. I'm going to leave it right there.
Now and then, there were some difficult moments. There was some arguing and so on. But all in all, I think that we got along really, really well. Sometimes it would be that Baruch would write a chapter, and then I'd look it over. Sometimes I would write a chapter, he'd look it over. Sometimes we actually sat together and wrote. Mm-hmm. And then, as you mentioned, my father, who's a retired English professor, sat with us. And it was a tremendous opportunity to have a husband and wife and father-in-law working together on something. I mean, we feel tremendously blessed that we were able to do this with my father also. And as I say, he's an English professor with very excellent grammar. And so you can be sure at least that all the commas and periods are in the right place.
That's something that stands out. It doesn't read like your classic English book about a Hebrew topic. You know, it's written well, and my partner edits things, and I didn't find anything. There was nothing there.
Right. So it actually went even beyond that, because it was the three of us, and we had of course a lot to do with the book, obviously writing it. But you know, it goes into so many different topics. David has mentioned before. There's chemistry, and there's marine biology, and there's physics, and there's archaeochemistry and marine archaeology, not to mention, you know, ancient history. So even though we've been doing research on this for 20 years, I didn't feel comfortable with a lot of those chapters going in until they were really checked by experts. And we sent them out all over the world to people all the way from Australia to
England
and you know, wherever we could, and find the people here, professors at Hebrew U, professors at Haifa, wherever we could, We sent them out to people to check and get their feedback to make sure that we were representing, you know, the story in an accurate way.
And with all that, there's no guarantee because there's always going to be somebody out there who's going to say,
"Always, oh yeah,
yeah."
Let me ask you, as well, actually, the truth is, all of us have seven kids. I think.
Look at that. So, yeah.
That's lucky 21. That's it.
How involved were your kids with the process? I mean, I've known your kids for a long time, so they were really good friends with my kids.
Right.
And this has to be really exciting. It's both their parents are super, you know, getting really excited about something. Well, did they come along with you to dive? Like, how did you run things by them? Did it pique their interest in things?
I would say not so much with writing the book, but in general, our house has become a trailette house.
They tie, right? Your kids, some of your kids tie.
Our kids are tires.
Yeah. And we know that your Friday floors are not mopped because you're running out to scuba dive. So I assume they had to pitch in there
too. Well, maybe we should explain what that means to tie.
Okay, go ahead.
Yes.
Okay, so
tie dye.
the trailer is on the corner strings that tzitzit of the prayer shawl is tied differently than white, and there are at least 27 different ways potentially of tying these, and some of them are very very intricate macrame types and so our children. By the time they're 12, 10 years old already, you know, how to do it. Right. They know how to do this.
We had one woman on her way to her son's wedding, and she realized that the tallit that they were going to stand under or that he was going to wear perhaps under the chuppah didn't have tchelet on it. And she was desperate. She came in her
emergency
wedding. And it happens all the time. In her wedding clothes, she came and she said, I'm on my way. I need the tchelet tied. So Baruch, you know, called up the stairs. Adiv, Yair, you did your run. And each kid took one corner. We have a picture of it. It's a beautiful, beautiful picture. And each kid tied and off she went to her son's wedding.
That's great. You know, this is really a question for Judy and for Eve, because this is a very male-oriented mitzvah.
That.
Whether it's the Kohen Gadol or where the mitzvah wearing tzitzit is very male-oriented. My great-grandmother, the Rebbetzin in Poland, she wore tzitzis.
Okay, that's not the first time I've heard about that generation.
Really? Yeah. And it's not usual, as Judy is saying, but here you have something that's very particular, or at least it's the association is male. And I remember years ago having a conversation with Ari Zavitovsky about maybe we should make something in the trailer world, you know, whether, you know, some kind of garment or some kind of thing, so women can feel connected to this very special kind of an adornment, because it's really something beautiful, as you were mentioning before. I personally wear the Rambam shtita, and I find, because it's the most, to me, it was the most beautiful way of tying it. When you hear about tchelet, what's your feeling about it? You're involved as a woman. Do you feel like you're an outsider? Do you feel like you're... What's your sense of it?
Not really. I don't really feel like an outsider because, again, the point of the trailer on the tzitzit is to remind you of all the mitzvot. So I don't feel the need necessarily to wear it to be reminded. I see it. I'm involved in it all the time. But just to go to what you were saying about something for the women to do, I have several things. I have a ring made out of the murex shell.
Oh, cool.
That they make in Croatia.
Cool.
They actually sort of like drill a hole into the shell, and you wear the whole shell
on your
finger.
And not with acid,
so
right?
So I don't know what they use, but that's one thing. And another thing that I have is a little menorah where they took the snail, poured some wax and a wick into the shell, and I have little candles that can light. Yeah, so we could go into that area.
So we could
if some
that.
Businessman or somebody wants to, you know, explore that area.
Yeah, but to follow with what Judy's saying, although it just popped in my mind that maybe that when a bride gets married, something old, something new, something barred, something blue.
Oh, good.
So we could start going with that. But no, I also feel, which in general I think with women and the fact that there's a lot of mitzvot that we don't have to do because we don't need to be reminded about Hashem. I mean, I'm online all day with him. You know, I don't need specific times.
Right. Yeah, he spoke to me this morning. He said he wants some time off.
I'm making him crazy.
That's it.
No, but I think that maybe women just have a more spiritual sense in general. I don't know.
I take a different view on it from my standpoint.
From your feminine side.
All right. No, the truth is, I think that women really, this is a great, beautiful mitzvah and commandment for women to take on themselves. Why not? Go for it.
Of wearing tzitzit.
Why not? It's a beautiful idea. In fact, if you look back...
If you're wearing an orange outfit.
Yeah, exactly. What are you going to do about that?
In the Talmud, there is one opinion, Rabbi Meir, who was of the opinion that women should wear tzitzit, and I think it's the Talmud or the Midrash says that he would tie the tzitzit for his daughters and wear them. So we only have one daughter, but that would be interesting. I don't know if she would be interested.
Yeah, next time I see her, I'll run. Yeah. Yeah, but no, maybe there is something, even if it's not a mitzvah. Yeah.
Right.
Some way of, and it would up sales. Of
exactly.
Also, which is definitely helpful.
Double
once
sales.
Once you get the women involved.
I knew some women as a kid, you know, had blue. They dyed their hair. It was kind of came out kind
well,
of blue.
We get,
yeah, that's right. You get that blue tint in the purple hair.
I don't think that was a religious imperative.
Probably not. Okay, so the book found its way to the 21st century. Here we are, and what's the response? You know, do you see that there's a growing interest in Tehillah in general, and what's the interest in the book?
Well, there is absolutely a growing interest in Tehillah, but we really have not even begun to scrape the surface. People don't know about it, and hopefully this book will start to increase the awareness and just in general bring to the larger population the idea of that there is this commandment that can now be fulfilled. Just a lot of people really have never heard of it and don't know anything about it.
Well, are you finding, though, difficulty in breaking through the rabbinic ranks here? Like, are there certain rabbis or certain sectors?
Without mentioning names.
No, without really mentioning names. You know, maybe the more, the Kippah Sergah, the national religious, versus the Hasidim or the Haredim. Or are there people who are more excited
and
willing to do it? Or
Eve, with your permission, Radzin or Hasidim, are they wearing your Tehillah or are they wearing Radzin Tehillah?
Right. Radzin Hasidim are going to continue to wear their Rebbe's Tehillah.
It's tradition.
And they should. And exactly, Eve, that word is the key word, tradition.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a tradition, if you will, of 1,300 years and even longer where Jews wore white strings on their talitot, on their prayer shawls. And that was the way it was. And very, very wonderful, great saintly men have done that for many, you know, for many, many years, hundreds and thousands of years. And so when we come along with this idea, it is new and it's going to meet with a certain amount of skepticism, mm-hmm. and it's certainly going to, and it's also going to meet with the, you know, a natural conservatism that any legal system has, let alone Judaism. So there are many, many people who are either not convinced, which is perfectly legitimate, if they're not convinced that this is the real source of the ancient
time. They can always hang their head on that.
Yeah.
Which we can't prove
absolutely.
With absolute certainty.
Right. Absolutely, and that's completely legitimate. And there's another attitude, which is even if we are convinced, it's going against our tradition, and the religion is a very, very important part of, most important part of the component is the traditional part of it. However, the lines that are drawn between people in general, the camps, I should say, that do wear Tehillah, that do embrace this new Tehillah, and those that don't, are very, very strange. It's not only along the normal division of camps that you would imagine. There are certain groups of Haredim, very, very religious people, like, for example, the Zilbermans in the Old City, who wear the tefillin all day long, who have an educational system where they learn 364 days a year.
Wow.
They are just about as saintly and religious as they come, and they all wear Tehillah from the time that the children wear their first
our
Tehillah, and they, you know, from the time the little children wear their first little tzitzit with a train on it, one?
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. My grandson.
Exactly. So they, from that time, they all wear their Tehillah. And even within the national religious, for example, parties, there are camps that some do and some don't. So it's very, very interesting to see where the divisions lie on this. And this issue of tradition is one that can't be underplayed. It's very, very important. It's something that everybody has to take into consideration, and they wonder about it.
It's all part of the discussion about Masorah in general. Masorah, I mean, it really goes beyond just the word tradition.
Yeah.
Masorah means that we're linking back over many, many generations, ultimately, we believe to Mount Sinai and that there was a divine commandment and that we can connect what we're doing now in terms of our particular Jewish behavior or religious behavior to that moment,
right?
What we've lost here in the historicity of Tehillah is a direct link that goes back historically. So,
for technical reasons.
Yeah, 100%.
Right.
Now, we have ways of restoring traditions. We have ways of restoring Masorah. One of the prime examples is in terms of the smicha process. In other words, even though the transmission of being, I'm going to use the word ordained, but it really goes beyond that, from rabbi to teacher, rabbi for starting from Moses, was broken, we can restore that. We can restore the Korban Pesach. There are ways, even though we haven't done it now for a very long time.
Paschal sacrifice.
But here we have a situation where people don't like doubt. People yeah. like absolutes. And you know what? If you learn anything from studying Judaism at all, is that there's a multiplicity of truth. There is not what we believe that there's Shivim Panim the Torah, that there are 70 facets, 70 ways of accessing and viewing and connecting with the Torah. And you have to be able to live with Elu Ve'elu Divrei Elukim Chaim, that people can have very divergent opinions and still be absolutely connected in terms of where they're standing. With the classic example is Hillel and Shammai. But here you have a situation where passions become very, I would say, explicit when you have things like this. And there have been cases in yeshivot and other where people became violent over slight changes and slight divergence. The Kotzke example is also a good story about how extreme and how passionate people can be when they believe a particular way is the absolute truth.
Threatened.
It's true. It's true what you're saying, but there is a slight difference between a distinction that should be made between the examples that you give of ideas that can be concepts that were lost to tradition that can be reintroduced, and tchelet. There is a slight distinction, and that is that in those cases, let's say ordination or the Pesach sacrifice, there was never really anything that was stopping anybody for the 100 years or the 1,000 years that this tradition had been lost. So you have a double problem with the tradition. You have one that the tradition is that we don't do it. And then on top of it, you have a tradition that nobody did anything about reinstating it, and they could have. Mm-hmm. In the case of Tchelet, it's not that way. Until 25 years ago, nobody could possibly have known any about mm-hmm. these ideas.
That's a good point.
So here we don't have the second problem. There is nothing that anybody could have done about it as much as they would have wanted to. And so now we have the opportunity for the first time to do something, and it's a question of authenticity versus tradition, and it is a big question. I'll just say one, you know, it's the area of ambiguity and paradox, and what better way to explain that than with a Hasidic tale?
All right.
I once had reason to be at the Boston Rebbe's house because I was doing some software work for them, and of course, as I was doing the programming, I gave him all the stuff on Tchelet, and I said, please, Rebbe, take a look at this and tell me, you know, what your ideas are. He said, okay, I'll read it over and I'll get back to you. And the next morning he came out, he said, I didn't sleep all night long. He goes, I felt this impossible burden weighing down on me. Two burdens, actually, he said. On one shoulder, I felt this crushing weight of a 1,000-year tradition and great saintly men who had only worn white, you know, for all that time on their prayer shawls, on their talitot. On the other hand, I felt the opportunity, this unbelievable potential weight that we could, for the first time now in so many years, in so many thousands of years, actually reenact and redo this mitzvah that was lost for so many times, the actual word of God. So he said, I felt those two weights all night long. And he said to me, I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to do, but I do believe that anybody approaching this has to feel both of those weights before they make the decision. Whatever the decision they decide is fine, as long as they feel those both easy. Crushing weights. Right?
Wow.
Well, that's a question that I don't even know if there is an answer to this. Was Tchelet a mandated mitzvah? In other words, this is really Tchelet, are people now breaking halacha by not wearing it? And the reason I'm thinking
it's a really good question.
We're talking about the Passover sacrifice, and there are those who will say, because you don't have to have a Beit HaMikdash for that, and you don't have to be in a state of ritual purity for that. So there's those who say, we should be doing it, but it's too politically fraught, and we're leaving it. And I have heard now opinions saying, we're sinning by not doing it. If we have the ability to do it and we're not doing it, that's a problem. Does Tchelet fall in that same category?
Well, like every good Jewish problem, it has it's an argument, depending on who you ask. There are, in earliest times in the Mishnah, The Mishnah says that Tchelet eina ma'akevet halavan, Tchelet can be worn without white, and white can be worn without Tchelet. So it seems that there are two parts of the commandment, and you have to try as best as you can to fulfill both of them, but they're not, you know, mutually exclusive. Mm-hmm. If you can only do one or only do the other, that's also fine. There are those that tend to believe, however, that when you do have the opportunity to wear Tchelet, it's ready, it's there sitting in front of you, and you decide not to, then that is actually a transgression of the law. And in fact, There are a number of rabbis today. There are many, many rabbis who say you shouldn't wear tchelet, of course. And there are many rabbis who say it's okay. There are many rabbis who say, you know what, you don't have anything to lose. But there are actually some rabbis who say, you're not going to wear tchelet, don't wear tzitzit at all. And that is a really extreme position.
Wow. Yeah.
And yes, and
I have some kids that would love that, you know.
Yeah, well,
exactly.
Right. Is there anyone saying, I have heard this briefly, that because it's expensive, one of the reasons that the rabbis are not coming out and saying you have to wear it is because it's a financial burden because it's expensive. Although tefillin, which nobody's saying you don't have to wear.
And you don't go through tefillin once a year. Right. Yeah, tefillin can last and should last a very long time,
well,
if not a lifetime.
It's color fast.
No, it's not the color. Is that especially the way our kids, you know, with sports and with sweating and with like the garments fall apart. And once they're tied, it's almost impossible to take them off and to keep them.
To put them on a new.
Yeah. So it's a more regular kind of recycling. So to speak, that you have to do.
We're doing our best to keep the price down and to lower the price. I mean, we're sensitive to that aspect. But of course, it is a very, very expensive process to get snails and to crush them and to ship them and so on.
And again, let's remember what the point of this mitzvah was. It was a beautiful, precious thing that you were wearing on your clothes.
It was valuable
specifically.
Because it wasn't easy to get.
Right.
Exactly.
There. Right.
Now, so we've heard that there are some rabbis who feel that it's too expensive or that it's hard for them to mandate to their followers to do this extreme expense. And, you know, there are options like that. Like, for example, when Rabbi Lior was asked, you know, how, you know, this is really, really expensive. What am I supposed to do? So his answer was, get a job.
So now we're seeing a whole social revolution based on the tchelet.
Yeah.
Okay. So, no, what you're saying is right. If I understand correctly, your organization also, though, will help people who really can't.
That's what I was just
going to
say.
Yeah,
exactly.
Go ahead.
Our goal is that anyone who wants tchelet can have tchelet. And so if someone complains that there's a financial issue, we'll do whatever we can to make it
possible. It's a nice gift
possible.
To give people.
Yeah, it's a beautiful bar mitzvah
gift.
Right, that's right. It is a beautiful gift.
The book and the tchelet.
Exactly.
As a package deal. Yeah, you should be packing bookmarks. That's with the little tassel.
We've thought of it all already. Yeah, of all that.
Well, that's good. So, Eve, you had some questions, but because we're sitting with a very, I would say, unusual couple in the sense of the way they do things, and this is one indication.
When they do them together is like fascinating.
That's
I didn't
already,
say we didn't argue. I said sometimes.
But just being able to argue and then get back to work and to get is already something.
Right.
So you had some questions about what they're doing in general.
Beyond the book.
Beyond the book.
I was just, if anybody, what is it, Times of Israel? You had a blog out there a couple of weeks ago, which was a totally different subject. But you guys have fostered, in addition to the seven that you're raising and snails that crawl around the house too, whatever it is, You've fostered a couple of kids and then given them away.
Right.
So how does that feel? How does that work? How are you able to do that?
It was one of the most difficult, or maybe even the most difficult thing we ever did, and also the most wonderful thing we ever did, because taking in two children, we did two babies from birth. One was with us for a year and 4 months, and one was with us for 5 months, I think. Bringing a baby into the house and loving the child was we got so much more out of the experience than we ever could have possibly imagined. Our children got so much more out of the experience than we ever could have imagined. And saying goodbye to them was very, very difficult, of course.
A year and 4 months is already a kid who builds very deep connections.
Oh,
that must have been very traumatic.
And we are very connected. We say, you know, these two children now have been adopted by other families, and thank God they're doing beautifully with these other families, and we're in contact with them, and we know that they're growing and flourishing and blossoming. But our feeling was, while these kids are with us, we're going to love them 100%, give everything that we can, and just be in the moment and don't think about what's going to happen tomorrow and don't think about what's going to be in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we did, difficult as it was, when they left. And we certainly think about them and miss them all the time. We say that there are these two children out there now who have no idea that there's a family that prays for them every day, thinks about them every day, misses them every day. They're part of our conversation all the time. But we gave them what we could while they were with us and then sent them off.
And what Judy's saying is like what Judy's saying is so true, because it's not even like you really have an option. It's not like thinking, oh well, they're only going to be with us for a little amount of time, so therefore we won't, you know, we'll hold back something
You don't know that with even children who are naturally born. There's no guarantees in life.
You have to live in the moment, really.
Exactly.
But this is what those kids needed at the moment that you took them in. And that was an amazing thing. So you responded at that time and then did what was necessary for those kids.
And we tell our kids all the time, who obviously miss these children a lot, we tell them what we gave these kids in the short time that they were with us, the self-confidence and the love and the sense of humor and the feeling of belonging and so on. That's going to they're going to take that with them wherever they go. That's theirs for life. Mm-hmm. And we gave them that.
You know, and even though they don't remember it, like I remember when we said goodbye to the boy, what kept going through my mind was this beautiful, beautiful midrash that in the womb the baby is taught all of the Torah by an angel, and then as it's exiting, you know, that beautiful place where it is, the angel touches the baby on its
the
lip,
and then he
forgets everything. So what you have to think about, of course, when you're wondering about that midrash is, well, then what did he learn it for in the first place if he's just going to forget everything? But the answer is that something remains, and even if they forget about it, that feeling that they have of feeling good, you know, let's say, for example, in this case of the midrash, feeling natural and feeling at home when you're learning Torah, that will stay with them forever. And that's what we kind of believed, you know, that whether they forget the particulars and they'll never remember our face and they'll never remember really any details of what happened in our house, we hope that somewhere deep inside they'll have this kind of self-confidence and maybe a sense of humor, or maybe some songs will feel good for them, or they'll just in general in life have this feeling that when they were young, they were loved.
Even if it's not conscious.
Absorbed.
I mean, I can't help but connect it to the trailer. It's like, this never fading love, just like the tchelet, what makes it so real is that it doesn't fade. It's color fast. So that love and confidence that you gave them is in there somewhere. It will never fade.
Yeah.
We hope so.
That's an incredible thing that you guys did. Really. So, and our listeners can't see that your eyes are fading. And we could see that it's...
So I'm going to ask, a directive question, right? Is there a speaking tour? Is there if people want you to come and lecture in their communities, right? What's next in terms of talking about
marketing
this book and yeah?
Well, definitely, we're excited to go out and start speaking about this. I've started already in a number of different communities around North America and
here in Israel too.
And here in Israel too, right? And
Is it catching on in North America? Are there more people in Israel just because this is where it's been happening?
Is it a geographical?
We have a lot of no question. We have a lot of work to do to bring this this out to people. And it, you know, it's the kind of thing that has been done very, very much on the low burner. We really haven't been pushing this for the last 20 years.
You all have jobs, you know.
Not just that. I think our approach has been, the approach of the foundation, the Petit Trailer Foundation, which makes the strings and markets the strings, our approach has been, let's not be in anybody's face.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not cause controversy. We're going to make it available. We're going to educate people about it. And let it go from there. And so far, that's been working. Our sales have been growing and growing and growing.
Mm-hmm.
But just from a natural standpoint, the four of us are here in Israel. So in Israel, that's where we've had so far the most opportunity and the most influence. But we definitely want to. And that the idea that this book will hopefully be able to bring this to a very, very, very wide audience, not necessarily religious, not necessarily even Jewish.
I was going to ask about that. Do you have people from other faiths interested in this?
Yeah, the book is hopefully accessible in terms of its content and the way it was written. It's accessible to anybody who has an interest, and there are people that have been blogging about it that are archaeologists that are, again, not necessarily Jewish, scientists and so on.
Right across. You should translate it into Spanish. There's all these people in South America that are very biblically oriented.
Yes.
Right. We'll get there too.
Or Hebrew.
We'll try to get there.
Well, first your translation has to be in Hebrew.
Anyway, back to the question. Yes, we do want to put together a speaking tour. I'm in America because of my day job. I'm in America at least once a month, and we're trying to coordinate that with a weekend as a scholar in residence. So if anybody is listening and wants to have,
so how do they get in touch with you?
Give some information.
Well,
a website?
Okay, so we have a website. The website is the name of the book, www.therarestblue.com. And you can contact us either through that, or you can contact us through email, Baruch Sturman, Baruch Sturman@gmail.com,
Sterman,
Sterman, right? Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And so anyway, you can get in touch with us in that way. And also our Tchelet organization has a website with tremendous amount of resources, articles and videos and multimedia library that really is. There's just an ocean of information that people can jump into if they want. And that's Tchelet. We spell it T-E-K-H-E-L-E-T. www.tchelet.com.
If you can pronounce it, it really means you're coming from, as you said, right, from a Spanish background.
But if you mention ocean, I could tell you that, I mean, as a tour guide, I've taken people not just to the Tchelet factory, yes, in Kfar Adumim, but also you could go diving with Moïse Navon, right, on the beach,
yes,
at Dor.
It's a wonderful day.
It's a beautiful
day.
Thing, yeah, to do, like at sunset.
But book early.
You
got to book, right, early, because, yeah, if you leave it to the last minute, he's going to say,
he's
I'm full.
He's going to be busy. And right, he shows the kids how you diet.
Right, so you actually go into the water, find the snails, with that very snail that some kid finds, he, right, cracks it open, he, right, does the whole dyeing right in front of you. And what's very exciting about the dyeing, we didn't really mention this yet, is that when the dye is in the container, it's yellow. In other words, right, it doesn't look anything like the color. You dip the wool into the container, you pull it out, and you expose it to the sun, and before your eyes, it turns blue. It's magic.
You just
it's
watch
magic.
The kids go,
yeah,
oh,
yeah, yeah. And again, you can imagine what the ancients felt when they, right, saw this magical, right, process. You can see why it had this mystique around it, because it's, yes, not your normal dye, which is the color of whatever it's gonna dye. It's wonderful.
There's a medieval phrase in Germany that he can do magic and blue dyeing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because they were associated, you know, with each other. People, you know, who knew the secrets of doing these transformations from one color to another. They were considered
exactly.
Oh, I liked what you said also at the very beginning of the book. It just took, you know, the whole thing with Joseph and the coat of many colors.
Right.
That idea of course his brothers were going to be jealous.
Yeah,
everyone was walking around
was.
In linen,
mm-hmm,
and he's got this really bright coat. Suddenly, put it in a whole different, right, perspective in the context of that time. How special that coat was.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
We have, yeah, you know, there's a Zohar, I think it is, that talks about in the days of the Messiah, a new color will be introduced into the, because right now we're based on seven primary colors, right? But that there will be a new color that in the time, and some people want to say, yeah, that we'll be sensitive to, we'll be able to see.
Wow.
First of all, we want to thank you for coming in. And we want to invite all those people who are listening to this to be in contact with Baruch and Judy Sterman and to find out more about Tchelet. And go buy the book, The Rarest Blue. It's really very accessible.
It's a great read.
And it's a fun read, even. And so don't be intimidated by all the highfalutin talking about the book here.
It's not a scientific book.
Right.
It's a novel.
Right. Yeah, it really is. It's a lot of fun. And it lends itself to a documentary. So if there are any documentary people out there listening to this, maybe Simcha, maybe somebody else.
Or a movie,
right?
Like this is becomes. They're all blue.
That's right. So thanks very much for coming in. We wish you a lot of luck.
Thank you.
This is David
Thank
Wilner.
You, David.
Eve Harrow.
And
thank you,
we'll catch you next time on Renegade Radio.
Super.